Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Short and hot with Chef Family. Short and hot with Chef Family.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, broadcasting to you live from Heritage Radio Network Studios outside of Roberta's Pizza, where the couple outside the window is eating a pizza that looks like they've been talking over for an hour. They're deep in conversation. I am so happy to be back. Thank you for listening to a pre-recorded show next week. I hope that you enjoyed Deborah Harkness and my story on sustainable seafood. Joining me today via telephone, I have two representatives of the Farmers Guild, which since 2012 has worked to establish an integrated network of social and professional hubs across California where farmers connect, collaborate, and find the resources that they need. Joining me now, Evan, hello, and Tiffany.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, I'm so glad you guys are here. So tell me about the Farmers Guild.
Sure. So the Farmers Guild is a network of local alliances around California, mostly Northern California, where folks who are involved in agriculture on various levels, whether that means they're at running their own farm, or they're just a farm intern, or if they're a farm-to-table chef, or they're working with farmers in some other way, come together once a month around a simple potluck and just share resources, information, talk about new policies that affect them, new practices they can implement, and get a chance to get off their farm and meet other farmers like themselves.
I love this because it's so simple and so elegant. It's like, let's just have a meal together and see, like, just talk.
Exactly, and that's pretty much how it began. It was just around a kitchen table and kind of just took off organically because there was a need for it.
And you are originally from Brooklyn, correct?
I was living in Brooklyn as about 4 or 5 years ago, actually, and I didn't live too far from where you are right now.
So how did you...
Bed-Stuy.
In Bed-Stuy, and what were you doing? You were working with community gardens?
Yeah, so well, I wasn't working so much as volunteering. I was actually working in the editor at a publishing company at the time, but got really involved. There was an abandoned plot in Bed-Stuy on my block where it was just sort of a bunch of overgrown weeds and, you know, broken Hennessy bottles. And me and a couple of the old folks on the block got together and decided we should do something about this space and started pulling out the broken glass and pulling out the weeds and brought in a bunch of soil, did raised beds, and a couple years later it was this thriving, beautiful little community garden where we were growing our own food and teaching the kids about where food comes from and connecting with our neighbors in a much new and far deeper way.
Is it still there?
You know, actually, a friend of mine from New York City passed through 2 days ago, and he actually told me he rode by and said that it was, in fact, still thriving, and there was vegetables coming up out of the ground, and there were people in there, and that was probably the best news I've heard in a very long time.
That's awesome. Congratulations. Where is it, in case people in our immediate listening area want to walk by and say hi?
Totally. It is on Hancock, between Tompkins and Throop.
I was a middle school teacher at PS 258, which is right there, and my maiden name is Carson, and my students used to say, Miss Carson, it's Troop, not Throop.
That's right.
I was corrected often by my kids. Okay, so then how did you get drawn out to California?
Well, I had basically, after about 5 years working in that garden, I became far more interested in being out in the garden, growing food, and learning about food than I was sitting in the office. So I had a friend of mine from a long time ago who ended up working on his family's ranch out in a place called Valley Ford, population 126. And he apparently took over management of the farm. And when I heard that, it all just kind of came together at the right time. And I called him up one day and said, how'd you like to have a ranch hand? And so I quit my job, left my apartment, and flew out to California, to this little town, and spent the next few years on a cattle ranch raising pigs and cows and chickens and ducks, and learning from sort of the back end how the food industry works.
And then how did you come to the Farmers Guild?
Well, so the Farmers Guild began with Meatloaf.
The singer or the dinner?
The dinner.
Okay.
it was, you know, we were on a cattle ranch and we had a lot of ground beef, obviously. So we were in a town of 126 people with primarily a lot like older fifth generation dairy families who, you know, it was definitely more closed off culture. And for young first generation farmers like ourselves, there wasn't a lot of community or accessibility, and we didn't really have the social networks or the family to kind of lean back on and ask for advice. So we just started, you know, having our own little dinner, and we'd make up a meatloaf, and we found out there were two other farms in the area with younger farmers as well. So we invited them over, sat around the table and just had a few beers. But the next week someone who was this guy who was raising sheep down the road, and he showed up for it. And then the following week, someone brought someone else. And the following week, this whole crew of people from this farm about, you know, 40 miles down the road showed up. And then it just started growing. It went from 6 people to 10 people to 20 to 50. And there's far too many people to fit around our table. But we had to call it off because it just became out of control. Young farmers and ranchers were just showing up, and you know, it was just this totally organic thing. We didn't send out invitations or anything. It just became Meatloaf Monday, and word got out about it. And finally, we had to put a stop to it. We had to get our work done, and there were all these people showing up at our house. And we called it off, but I looked around and realized, why are all these people showing up? I mean, what is it that is drawing all these young agrarians to our kitchen? And just realized that there was a whole lot more than just drinking beer and eating meatloaf going on in that kitchen. There were partnerships being made. There were skills being shared. There were people sitting down to talk shop and talk about the price of alfalfa, or talk about where to get your supplies or what markets to work at. Or there were, you know, people who were starting to sell each other's products at their respective markets. There were three farms ended up going in on a whole silo together so they could get bulk deliveries of chicken feed and share it and save a lot of money doing that. So there was, and then the other reason was simply that, you know, I was living in a town. I went from New York City to a town of 126 people. It was hard to meet people, especially people our age. And that was the case for a lot of young people getting on the farms. It's isolating, and there's not a lot of opportunity to get out and meet people, especially people who understand agriculture and understand the lifestyle. So people were hungry for that connection, and we provided it in our kitchen, and suddenly decided that it deserved a name and called it the Farmers Guild, moved it out of our kitchen to a friend's much larger kitchen in town, and then eventually we outgrew that space, so we moved over to our local Grange Hall, where we've been meeting ever since, and nowadays we get average of 70 people showing up to our Farmers Guild. Young people, old people, farmers, ranchers, local food advocates, farmer table chefs, all sorts of different people. It's a very diverse community. And over the course of the last year, the model has been replicated, and we've helped to start 7 Farmers Guilds around California now, from Mendocino to Nevada County all the way down to Santa Cruz.
So the same model is happening. Is it also meatloaf on Mondays?
No, it's not. We've actually moved on from the meatloaf. We're far more diverse now.
So what is the age of the average American farmer?
The average age of the American farmer is 58 and rising.
Why is that?
There's a lot of reasons. The agricultural industry is not what it used to be. You have these people who spend, you know, incredibly long hours out in the field trying to grow food, and it's hard work. It's a lot of labor. And over the course of the last 100 years, the agricultural industry has conglomerated to such a degree that there's these, you know, vertically integrated companies that own almost every single element in the production system, and farmers are sort of relegated into this pretty specific, pre-designated role where they don't have a lot of options, they don't have a lot of say in how much they charge for their products. They get put in these really difficult contracts where the company is basically telling them how to grow and how much they're going to pay for it. And when you have, say, for instance, you know, pork is an example, just because we raise pigs, there's one company that owns, you know, a vast majority of all pork consumed in America called Smithfield, and it's now owned by a Chinese company. And they control everything from the packaging of the pork to they own the genetics of the pig.
So it's terrifying.
It is very frightening. And for someone who's trying to grow food, they're basically put into this system. And if you're, you know, a struggling farmer trying to save your farm with land prices skyrocketing, and you're up against, you're basically sitting down to negotiate with a company that is multi-billion-dollar company, you are at a disadvantage.
That's the understatement of the year.
Yes.
So are you finding that in these meetings of the guilds that there are ways to work around that structure?
Absolutely.
So give me an example of how someone is doing that successfully.
Shop at your farmer's market. When I show up to the farmer's market to sell our, you know, our beef or our eggs or our pork, I can set my prices at whatever I want. Obviously, it's, you know, I have to deal with whatever the market expects and, you know, supply and demand, but I get to have a conversation, a direct conversation with my customer to say where that food came from, how it was raised, and why they should buy it, even if it's going to be more expensive than what you might find prepackaged in cellophane at your grocery store.
Right. I often tell people who say to me, well, why is it, you know, it's a dollar an egg in New York City if you buy them at the farmer's market. I'm like, you can look the person who is raising the chickens in the face and thank them for raising your eggs. Like, there's no loss in the humanity between our food, like where our food is, the person who's growing our food and the person who's receiving the money for that same food. And when you point that out to people, most of them, it's like a revelation. Like, yeah, that is true. I hadn't thought about why my 99-cent eggs, dollar a dozen instead of dollar an egg are preferable or less preferable.
And I would definitely encourage everyone to go out and get two dozen eggs, get an eggs from pasture-raised eggs from a farmer's market and your, you know, cheap eggs from the grocery store and just crack them open side by side. You'll see the difference, and you'll taste the difference. And then there's beyond that, it's industry that's producing those other eggs. It's a single bottom line. There's very little care for how those eggs are being produced in ways that provide social equity for the people involved in the farm, that basically create most poultry farmers in America are the equivalent of indentured servants.
Right, I've heard this.
They enter into a contract with the supplier, who distributes the eggs, and in order to meet the expectations of the wholesaler who sells the eggs, they have to produce in ways that the company thinks is more efficient. So even if the farmer wants to, say, for instance, provide outdoor access to their chickens, even if the farmer wants to avoid using harmful chemicals that are going to ruin the health of the chickens or endanger the health of the consumers or destroy our natural resources, it's not really a choice. They're in a contract that says we will buy all your eggs if you produce the eggs in this way. And the way that they want you to produce those eggs is we want the most amount of chickens with the least amount of resources possible. And right. That is an equation for the horrendous food system that we have today.
And so how is the Farmers Guild, how are you guys working to change this? Like, what are some of the conversations that people are having?
Well, one thing is collaboration and communication. It's as simple as that. If for instance, I think agriculture can be isolating, as I said, and you don't really know what other opportunities are out there unless you talk to other farmers. If you can find out from other farmers the kind of innovative mobile chicken tractors that they have created with just traps lying around their farm, and found out that you can actually, fertilize pasture land by following cows with your mobile chicken coops, that you're actually providing a resource to a diversified farm. You're able to stack functions. And basically, the Farmers Guild, people get together and talk about these things. They're able to share notes and improve their practices. If you show up to the Farmers Guild, you can find out about grants that are available. We just recently announced the Animal Welfare Approved has new grants available for farmers who are looking to improve the livelihoods of their animals. So you can actually, there are actually resources out there to encourage you, to give you incentive to do what most of the farmers we work with are already doing, which is providing a decent life for the farms, the animals they work with.
And taking back our food system from scary corporate big agriculture.
Exactly. And so one of the other things we do is we do a lot of outreach to our local community about knowing your local farms. So a lot of people don't know that they have access to local farms. They think they can just go to Whole Foods and everything is available to them, and of course it's local food, but that's not always necessarily the case.
Right.
But there are so many CSA models, there's herd share models. I mean, you can come to our farm and actually buy into a share of a cow, where you can get raw local Jersey cow milk, where you can pick it up every week and it's fresh and available to you. And we as the farmers will actually hand you that jar, and there, you know, right over the fence, you can see the cows themselves, and that's available to you. And we reach out to the community to let them know about these opportunities, as well as letting them know about the challenges that the farmers are up against, whether that be regulations that make it incredibly hard for small-scale farmers to meet the demands. The permitting is oftentimes a huge issue. There are huge farms can basically hire, get an entire department together to manage permitting and regulation, whereas if you got a small family farm, not only do they have to market themselves and feed the animals and build the repair the barn and do all of that, but then they also have to figure out permitting and licensing and abiding by all the regulations. It's a system that is pretty puts small farms at a huge disadvantage.
So how can people help? I have put a link to the Farmers Guild on sharpandhot.com, and that'll take you directly to your website. And what else do you need from the general public in order to help spread the word about the Farmers Guild?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, first off, shop at your farmer's market, join a CSA, go have a conversation with a farmer, ask them what challenges they're up against, ask them why they do what they do, as far as the Farmers Guild goes, if you're here in California, I recommend checking our website. We do a lot of events for not just farmers, but for people who are just interested in agriculture. A couple weeks ago, we had a big summer festival where we had a whole hog roast, and we had live music, and all the farmers came out, and we invited the general public to come and join us. And we had T-post pounding competitions and drip tape jump rope and all sorts of fun games. So check that out and come join us at one of those. And lastly, we are in the middle of a crowdfunding campaign where we are looking to raise money to get our nonprofit organization up off the ground so we can continue doing the work that we do for these local farmers guilds around California. We have 3 days left, and we are 87% funded.
You're so close. I'm looking at your page right now. You need just under $2,000 in 3 days.
That's right. And okay. we have 135 backers, which has been incredibly inspiring. The people who have given to this campaign, and there's different prize levels, everything from stickers to T-shirts to milking classes to, you know, gourmet dinners on farms. But when I'm able to look at the number of backers, it's incredible that the people who have given to the Farmers Guild, we're talking neighbors and friends, but also young, struggling farmers who have very little to give. They see the value in the Farmers Guild, and they've pitched in what they can. So seeing the community show up and really support this has been the most inspiring thing that's happened to us so far.
Evan, I have to leave it there. Thank you so much. I challenge the listeners of Sharp and Hot to go over to sharpandhot.com. You will see the link to the Farmers Guild, and you'll see right there Evan's face where it says 3 days left, you can help. Help make the food system more sustainable. Thank you so much for coming on. After the break, we have Sean DeTore, my podcaster friend from Seattle, who's going to talk about his homemade ho-hos, and my dear friend Casey Barber, author of Classic Snacks Made from Scratch, and they're going to talk about how to make fun, punny food. See you after the break.
Is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot, everybody. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson. I want to say a huge thank you to our official coffee sponsor, Kraft Coffee. I got my new delivery for the month of July, and we have been savoring all of the deliciousness that they have found and selected, especially for us, things that I would never have thought to purchase for myself. And all I have to do is open my mailbox, and in it is. KraftCoffee.com. Use code SHARP at checkout, and you get 10% off of your order. Now, joining me on the phone is my darling friend Sean and my other darling friend Casey, who don't know each other yet, but they're about to meet and over a love of classic snack foods. Sean, Casey, hello.
Hi. Hello.
Thank you both so much for coming on Sharp and Hot. So, Sean, tell me about how you came to make your own ho-hos, which I have put a picture of up on sharpandhot.com for people to see how beautiful they look.
Yeah, well, thanks. So my friends and I are in a TV food club, and we've been doing this thing for like over 2 years, where every month or month and a half or so, we go to each other's house and we choose a TV show that we grew up on. Growing pains. Strangers. This last time was Pee Wee's Playhouse. So you have to make a pun themed food. So I made Mecca Lecca High, Mecca Heiny homemade ho hos. I don't bake a lot. I know Chef Emily, probably have your hands in all sorts of pots and pans, right?
I occasionally do, but I have to say I am not, baking is not my first love at this point in my life.
Okay, that would be your husband, and then cooking would be your second.
My husband, then my kid, and then cooking, and then baking. So baking's like fourth on the list right now.
Okay, so I'm not a seasoned baker, but that was how I came up with the idea of making homemade ho-hos, and they came out so great. They were a massive hit, and they were actually quite easy to make. I mean, it's a lot of just doing it, as with most any recipe, just doing it, make sure you're doing it step by step and getting it as precise as you can. But that was sort of how the idea came about for the homemade ho-ho.
So, Casey, do you have Ho-Hos in Classic Snacks Made from Scratch, your cookbook?
I actually do not, and I'm looking at the picture right now, and they look incredible. I'm so impressed. So
thank you, Casey. I took a look at your book. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I had to make a command decision when going through Classic Snacks Made from Scratch. There are so many chocolate cake with some sort of cream filling / frosting snacks out there, and Ho-Ho's got ditched for Devil Dogs.
Yeah, I was taking a look through your book, and there are so many great snacks in there that I want to make. I have so many other questions for you that we probably can't even... This isn't my show, but I have so many questions for you about your
book. Oh, no, Sean, go ahead. Ask away. We have all the time in the world.
No, I'm just curious, like, why did you decide to come up with this book? I mean, obviously you have a love for all of these amazing snacks. And what was your inspiration for this?
The short answer is I am insane and, like you, have this weird compulsion to make something from real cake and frosting that you could easily buy in a store, but it just seems kind of more fun to try to recreate it on your own. And my husband started asking me for homemade Oreos and homemade Chubby Hubby ice cream and all these things, and I just decided to make a whole book around the topic.
That's awesome.
So now that satisfies, Sean, your need for anytime you need a classic snack. Now all you have to do is find a pun to match the snack instead of the other way around.
That's exactly right. And I think I'm going to have to pick up Casey's book because I was looking through it on Amazon and it looks freaking cool.
What were some of the other dishes that people made, the other punny dishes?
Let's see.
Did Terry the Pteranodon?
No, I'm trying to think now. We had so much food. Oh, someone made, penne pasta. You know, that little penne, claymation character that's on the show sometimes?
Yep.
Yeah, so penne pasta. There were a few others. I can't quite. I'd take up the rest of your show, Emily, just trying to think what they were off the top of my head. So I think we should move on.
I love the idea of a food-based, like, show watching. And I'm not sure that I would be the best person to come to this party because I didn't have a television we had a television in the house, but it wasn't attached to any cable. So there were so many things that I missed out on. Like, I know Reading Rainbow was this big social media thing a couple of weeks ago, and it was totally lost on me.
Right. Well, so then if you had a pun food party, your shows would all be like the 5 o'clock news, and it would be really boring and,
yep,
you know, all about murder and a cute kitten found in a well, but
that's 100% what was I used to joke that we got three channels, static, and the news.
Right. Well, there you go. You're welcome to my party anytime if you want to bring it down with murder and hurricanes.
I could totally do murder and hurricanes, like cocktail style. So, Sean, did you run into any problems making your ho-hos? Like anything that you want Casey's expertise, like frosting or rolling or anything that you need help with?
Well, there was one thing, and I may have come up with a solution just in my own head, but I want to know. So, for the cake, I had no problem making the batter and doing all of that. I put the cake batter on two cookie sheets, metal cookie sheets to put in the oven and cook for about 15 minutes each. What I did was I put one cookie sheet with the frosting, or not the frosting, I'm sorry, the cake batter. Mm-hmm. On the bottom shelf and one on the top shelf, and then halfway through rotated them so they could get kind of like an even cooking or an even bake. But one of them came out a little bit too rough around the edges, a little bit too crusty. So I'm wondering, like, should I have just baked them one at a time, or maybe I just didn't have enough batter on that part of the, you know, pan? What do you think?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the problem with anything you bake in an oven is that you are baking it in an oven, which is a notoriously confounding piece of kitchen equipment, which people don't realize that, you know, their ovens have hot spots and they have cool spots. And, you know, maybe their oven really doesn't get up to 350 degrees, or maybe it runs hot to 375. So it's not you. It's probably not even your pans, but it could be, you know, maybe your pan just heats differently in a certain spot in the oven. So maybe baking them one at a time and rotating that single pan if you're really going for complete synchronicity with the homemade ho-ho. Or you could just chalk it up to the fact that things are homemade and they sometimes do have a little bit of a thickness here, a little bit of a thinness there that's not present in a machine-made version, and just kind of run with it that way. Some of my Twinkies end up a little tanner than others do, just because my oven has hot spots too, or I put the nonstick spray on a little too heavy in areas, but they still taste like Twinkies, and people seem to be pretty happy with that.
We just invested in an oven thermometer, and our oven is 50 degrees off what the dial says.
Holy crap!
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's also crooked because our floor is crooked, and so things are... it's like a member... Our oven is a member of our family, and I talk to it as though it is a human being when I put something in there, and I say a little prayer.
Wow.
Seriously, so you have a crazy uncle of an oven.
I do. I have a crazy uncle oven. Maybe that's what we'll start calling it.
50 degrees hotter or not as hot? Which way does it veer?
Cold. So if I have it set to 350, it's actually only 300.
Oh,
so
wow.
I have to, like, but it doesn't, it's not, like, linear. I can't turn it up to 400 and it be 350 because it's not consistent like that. And so it just requires a lot of babysitting, and it could explain why baking hasn't been one of my priorities, because it's been a lot of failures.
Makes sense.
Excuse me.
You see what professionals have to go through. We're just like Us Weekly. We're real people too.
We're exactly like Us Weekly. All right, Sean, what's the next TV show that you all are going to be cooking for next month? Do you know yet?
Let's see. I don't know what show it's going to be yet, but I know what friend is going to be hosting, but that doesn't really matter for what you're asking. So, no, I don't know what show it's going to be yet, but I can't wait to make something. This is, the homemade ho-hos is one of my top five menu items that has turned out so great that I'm definitely going to make these again.
Awesome. Sean, how can people...
Yeah, it's your move.
How can people find out more about you, Sean?
People can find me on the internet if you want to search out mynorthwest.com/mixtape. That's my podcast. I'm also on Facebook. I think it's facebook.com/mixtapeSean. But if you want to look those things up, you can find some of my work and stuff on the internet.
Awesome. And Casey, your website?
You can find me pretty much all of the time on goodfoodstories.com, and there actually happens to be a homemade ice cream drumstick cones recipe up right now with homemade peanut butter caramel in the centers of them if you need more classic snacks options. And on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Good Food Stories and Classic Snacks is available wherever books are sold.
Awesome. Both of you are wonderful friends of mine, and I hope to have you both on again soon. Sean, tweet me when you know what the next show is, and maybe we can get some listener suggestions for puns.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chef Emily, for having me on your show again today. And Casey, it was nice to meet you.
Great to meet you, too.
I'll talk to you guys later. Next week, we're going to do another pre-record. I have a little bit of a scandalous confession to make, which is that during this time slot on August 5th, I have been invited by Landlady. I hope you listened. If you haven't, go back and listen to the show. They performed live in the Heritage Radio Network studios, and it was amazing. They are going to be performing live at a partner public radio station in New York City called WFUV that airs from Fordham University, and they have invited me to come and bring my prize-winning peanut butter cookies, which is an opportunity I was so warmed and charmed by. I absolutely had to say yes. So what I have set up for you are two author interviews, both New York Times bestsellers right now. Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch, which is a nonfiction look at the future of American seafood. And notice a theme, I'm really on the sustainable seafood thing. And also Emma Straub, whose new book called The Vacationers, I believe, is currently number 4. She and I talk about researching food in foreign places. So stay tuned for that. Thanks again to Kraft Coffee, craftcoffee.com. Use code SHARP at checkout. You get 10% off your coffee order. I can't recommend them highly enough. And until next week, everybody, keep playing with fire and knives.
Sharp and hot with Chef Family. Sharp and hot with Chef Family.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.